Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data? Today is May 9th, 2018. It's a beautiful day in New York today, and the weather has been perfect. Welcome to the Personal Computer Show. This is the original personal computer radio show of all things computing. I'm Hank Key, and my colleague is Joe King. Podcasts of the program is available on wbai.org/archive, also available on prn.fm, and on our website pcradioshow.org. We are on WBAI-FM 99.5 on the radio in New York, and prn.fm on the internet each Wednesday with essentially the same program, except when WBAI is in a membership drive. The programs are, well, a little different. Tonight, we will be covering headline news, which features Facebook's clear history privacy option. Well, what is it? Facebook plans to offer members a tool to prevent tracking of their online activity outside the network. The clear history feature will allow users to see which websites and applications send Facebook information when they use them. And thousands of mobile apps for children might be violating their privacy. An international survey group of researchers analyzed 5,855 apps for children and found that 57% may be violating the U.S. Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, C-O-P-P-A. And we'll be covering fake WhatsApp, which is being downloaded more than 1 million times from the Google Play Store. Facebook Clear History Privacy Option. Facebook plans to offer members a tool that to prevent tracking of users' online activity outside the network. The Clear History feature will allow users to see which websites and applications send Facebook information when they use them. It will allow the users to delete the data and prevent Facebook from collecting and storing it in the future. Although that information would not be associated with the user's account, it still would be used in anonymized form to provide website operators and app developers with analytic information about Facebook users. Facebook spokesman said it would take a few months to build the clear history option. They'll work with privacy advocates, academics, policymakers, regulators to get the input to their business approach, including how they plan to remove identifying information and the rare case when they need the information for security purposes. While clear history is a step towards securing more privacy for Facebook members, it remains to be seen how significant it will be. I see it more as a public relations ploy than addressing the real problem. Facebook has lost some of its shine. Facebook CEO Mark Zuckerberg has been taking so much heat lately that he needed to do something as opposed to just saying something. This clear history option feature puts the burden of privacy on individuals who are already overwhelmed with the number of features available on Facebook. It gives sites like Facebook an easy excuse for saying that they are doing something about privacy, but the likely scenario is that few people will know about this feature and actually use it in practice. This clear history is a privacy placebo because they make some people feel better about privacy when in practice it often does very little about actually doing anything in improving privacy. However, this does not address privacy concerns that people have about other aspects of their Facebook use, such as their interactions with the platform and other users on Facebook itself. I have a suggestion as how they can quickly implement this clear history option. Do not collect tracking of user online activity outside the network. However, Facebook feels that the collection of data is vital to their business model as their subscriber base is the product, then simply build a clear history option to be global in which the subscriber can simply say yes or no to all sites. Do you know who has your personal data? Let me ask the question differently. Do you know who is using your personal data?
Hey, Joe, all those comments are really my own thoughts on it, and you may disagree. And what say you, Joe?
It's a very interesting thing that we're being faced with. We're asking Facebook, we're telling and demanding Facebook, give up its method of making money. Well, who's going to pay for Facebook then? This whole question is a much more complicated one, Hank, because...
Hey, Joe, can you hold the phone a little differently because of your popping?
I am popping because I am popping. I'm a very poppy guy. I like popcorn. Mark Zuckerberg is faced with a really serious problem because he's being asked, as I said, to give up his method of making money. The people who've been in the mail order business, I used to be in that business, know full well that on a continuity series or a membership series, negative option is the only way it works. By negative option, I mean you get it until you tell me to stop sending it. To get a positive option to work is virtually impossible. In other words, if he wants the members of Facebook to come in and say, yes, I do want you to collect your information, or yes, I want you to stop it, it's just not going to work for the user or for the member or for him. It's a very complex thing. I know why he seems to be obfuscating. He seems to be saying it'll take time to develop. It's a very bad situation on both sides. I have an easy solution for him. Have two memberships. One, they collect whatever data they want, and it's free. Two, they have a paid membership who doesn't collect any data. How much you would have to pay? My guess is far more than you'd be willing to pay. That's the problem.
Hey, Joe, let me just switch subject on you while you adjust your phone, okay? If you could just, fix the microphone on it. There's another subject that I want to have you talk about with me, and that's the fact that there is a United States Children Online Privacy Protection Act, and that this is supposed to prevent really spying on kids. Now, there was a study that was made or conducted in over, two continents, one in Europe and one in the United States. And what they found was that there were over 5,855 applications that they looked at for kids. And they found that 57% of them may be violating the COPPA, or the Children Online Privacy Protection Act. And now I realize some of the data I'm going to give you sound somewhat dry, but basically what got me was there's a whole lot of data there, but 73% of the apps were transmitting confidential data over the internet based on what the kids were doing. That is like outrageous. I don't know how I can hold my anger on that.
Well, we're back again to what I was saying just a minute ago. All of these systems, all of these apps are based on the same system. If it's a free app, then you, the user of the app, is the product, and you will get bought and sold. If you want to, there are apps out there that charge. They're $5, $3, $10. Those apps can get away with not selling you, because you're buying it. People want to get things free, and I don't blame them. I want to get things free, too. Information should be free is the old hacker's motto, back when the word hacker was not a dirty word. But I'm not surprised at all when you tell me that companies, even like Disney, are violating the COPPA law. They have to.
Now, Joe, it's a slippery slope, okay, because what makes you think that if you were to pay for it, that they would stop doing it? I remember back in the early days with cable TV, they said, gee, if you subscribe to cable, you won't see any advertising. Guess what? Yes. In the early days, there was no advertising, but very quickly, advertising came with the program, whether you pay for it or not.
Well, that's not really so, Hank. I pay for HBO. I don't have advertising on it. I pay for Netflix. I don't have advertising on it. I pay for Showtime. I don't have advertising on it. If you don't want advertising, then you have to pay a membership fee that's sufficient to give a profit to the company that's selling you the product. If you want the product free or at a low price, then you're going to have to let them make money some other way. It's to me, it's so obvious. I don't know why the people in the government have a problem understanding this.
Well, I think that one of the problems I have with that kind of a business model is that you say there are no ads. I have HBO. I have Showtime. There are ads, but they're sort of like they're ads, or let's say they're more infomercial rather than outright ads. Okay.
Then that's your answer. You can't change your definition to fit your argument, Hank. If they have ads, you find that if they have sponsor ads, you find them objectionable. If they have information, such as coming attractions, you find that objectionable. You can't. I'm sorry. To me, your point is not logical.
Well, my point is that there's a law, a U.S. Children's Online Privacy Protection Act.
And let me interrupt you. The Children's Online Privacy Protection Act, COPPA, simply says if you want to provide product for children, you're not allowed to make a profit or break even. That's what the law says. Oh, of course people are going to try and break it. Whoever passed the law didn't have a half a brain in their head.
No, that's not true at all.
There has to be a way for the people to afford to provide the product.
Joe, you know as well as me that the people who write the legislation are the people who stand to benefit from it, and they'll write it in the manner and with
not
a proper...
Not in the case of the COPPA law.
Well,
just the opposite. It was written by people who had the best intentions of the world, but it is impractical. Let me put it another way. Suppose they pass in Washington a law that says to have a car on a public highway, it has to get 100 miles per gallon. They pass the law. Will anybody obey that law? Or will everybody find a way to break the law because there are no cars that give you 100 miles per gallon?
Well,
they can pass whatever law they want in Washington. It doesn't have to make sense. As a matter of fact, many of them right now don't make sense.
Okay. Well, let's hope that, when it comes with kids, I
think that it's up to the parent.
Well,
or guardian.
I think
charge of the child to choose what they do on the computer.
Yeah, I was going to say that as parents or grandparents or great grandparents, if you have kids in your home, you should be take an active role to find out what are they doing on the smartphone, what are they doing on the computer. Don't just say, "Oh, it's a Disney product or it's an XYZ product."
It's a matter of habit. Do you know of any parent who would sit around doing nothing while they watched their kids reading pornographic magazines? No, of course you don't know of any parent who would do that. So why are they letting them watch whatever they want to on television? They're saying, oh, it's a Disney product. It's got to be sweet and it's got to be good. Have they checked it out first to see whether it's sweet and good? A book is easy to check out. You read through it. And if it's full of dirty words, you don't let your kid read it.
Hey, Joe, there's
an app. How do they check it out?
There's another thing I want to cover. It's there is a fake WhatsApp that is being downloaded by more than a million users. And what it is that WhatsApp is a legitimate program, but there's one with the word update in front of it. And people think it is the WhatsApp because the logo, the form, the appearance all look like the original. Are you aware of that?
I was not aware of it. And when you pointed it out to me, I did a little bit of checking on it. And when you see in a legitimate place like the Google Store a product that is called Update WhatsApp something or other with the logo, of course you think it's the real thing. Now, here's where Apple had the edge. This was only available in the Android format, so it was only on the Google Store. What I think happened was they figured out that the Apple Store would have discovered what it was much more quickly than the Google did. As you said, there were millions out there before Google pulled it off the market.
Yes, and that's unfortunate.
It's more than that, Hank. The first time I'm not a WhatsApp user. The first time I heard about it was when you told me about it. I did, as a matter of fact, check whether by accident in the early days without thinking I had downloaded anything about WhatsApp. I had not. But now what happens? People out there are first hearing about it now, listening to the show. What happens to them?
Well, go check it, and if you see it, uninstall it.
How do you know it? It's got a legitimate logo.
It doesn't. Well, if you go to the WhatsApp site, then you, in other words.
I got another suggestion.
Okay.
If you've got an Android phone or an Android tablet, go into the section where you can see the list of apps.
Mm-hmm.
And if you have two WhatsApp logos, you've been hit. You have to decide which of those two is legitimate and erase the other one, or what you can do, what I suggest you
erase
do.
Erase all of it and go back to the original site to get it.
That's right.
Right. Hey, there's one more thing I really want to quickly go into. This is very important because the U.S. Food and Drug Administration had just approved of a patch for pacemakers. What happened was that there were about...
Wait a minute.
Let me finish this.
The medical pacemaker?
Yes.
The one that's inserted in your heart?
Yes. There was the Abbott pacemaker. About 465,000 patients are affected by this, so that's a big deal. And they were told about a year and a half ago that there was a vulnerability, a bug in it, and they went to court and say, no, we do not. And it went to the court, then it went to a third party. They said, yes, it is a bug. And the FDA now had said, gone back to the Abbott, by the way, it's formerly known as St. Jude Medical, say, hey, fix it. And the patch was released in January, but I didn't see any public notification on it. I mean, 465,000 people have this pacemaker inserted. That's a big deal.
Yes, but all of the hospitals and doctors who have worked with that particular pacemaker were notified of it.
Yes, but the thing is, if you haven't seen your doctor in a while...
Well, in this case, if you haven't seen the doctor in a long time, you should call and make an appointment anyway for getting the pacemaker. It's not good for you. But the doctors and hospitals are contacting the patients. In some cases... the doctors have one way of handling it, in some cases another. However, the doctors want to handle it, I have more confidence in than having the government handle it.
Well, I think what I'm more upset with was the maker, Abbott. I mean, if someone comes up to you and say, hey, we found a problem with your device, and they take them to court to say, no, it's not, instead of saying, oh, let me look at it and see if I have a real problem.
There I agree with you. I think those people should be, as a matter of fact, how much you want to bet that in a short while we'll hear about lawsuits against that company?
Well,
there are lawyers out there who are just waiting for somebody to screw up.
The other thing is the media should have some means of saying things like this. They should just say, it doesn't have to be sensational news. It doesn't have to be like, earthquake or something like that. Hey, have a section where, recalls or things like this that people should be aware of.
And nobody would read it.
I guess it's people like us that are concerned, and we go about telling the world about it, and hopefully people will be tuning in. And, well, so be it. And, hey, Joe, I'm done with this.
What is Amazon Video? Amazon Video is an internet video on-demand service that is developed, owned, and operated by Amazon.
It offers television shows and films for rent or purchase, and Prime Video, a selection of Amazon Studios, original content, and license acquisitions included in the Amazon's Prime subscription. Prime members can watch thousands of movies and TV shows at no extra cost with Prime Video. You also have the option to purchase Amazon channel subscriptions to Showtime, Stars, and other streaming entertainment channels through Prime Video. Well, it is said that there is no honor among thieves. This mantra gets applied to the pirating community by its enemies, with those that rip and or view pirated content without any payment whatsoever. Any value or benefit derived from this community is denied or ignored, with the spotlight being only on the inflated injury this same community inflicts on unimaginably wealthy companies and studios, at least that is those who are ripped off. Pirate communities often buys more content than does their non-pirating cousins. This, however, does not excuse copyright infringements. But the world is not all black and white and is instead muddled with complicated and it's quite mushy. Well, how is this all related to Amazon Video? Much like Amazon's streaming service the past few weeks, a fact we only really know about due to the same pirating community doing investigation work for free. This week, there's been a sustained chorus of disapproval over the quality of pirate video releases sourced from Amazon Prime. The anger is usually directed at piracy groups who fail to capture content in the correct manner, but according to a number of observers, the problem is actually at Amazon's end. The discussion on Reddit, for example, report that episodes in a single TV series have been declining in file size and bitrate. Some have theorized Amazon is trying to save on bandwidth expenses. While this is a possibility, the company hasn't made any announcements to that end. Reports suggest that drop in quality is no small thing, and further investigation has shown that the streaming quality via Amazon Prime has had something like a 50% drop. Why Amazon thought that downgrading its streaming quality was a good idea, we don't know, but what doesn't seem to be in question, however, is that it did so on purpose. Amazon, in their infinite wisdom, have decided to make adjustments with the quality of their encodes, and the upshot is that the streaming quality has been cut in half in the way it looks in an attempt to serve videos at reduced bandwidth. As of the past few days, it seems that Amazon has made changes on its end and restored the original quality of Prime streams. The company is still refusing to provide any kind of explanation as to why any of this has happened, and, well, it's quite clear that without the pirating community calling them out, Amazon's customer service claims that all issues were at the user end and not with the stream itself. Without the pirate hobbyists, they would have gotten away with it. This evening, for feature segments, we have from Dr. Alfred Poor in Wearable and Health Technologies, fitness bands that help smokers quit, patients want telehealth options, and inexpensive artificial muscle lifts 12,000 times its own weight. Wow, I got to get one of them. And I will, from the Tech Corner, be talking about 5G and the Internet of Things. And Marty Winston will be talking about the cybernetic house should auto-adjust if you happen to doze off while watching TV as part of his home automation segment.
Hello, this is Alfred Poor with news about wearables and digital health technology from Health Tech Insider.
Let's face it, quitting smoking is hard. People try and try, and some succeed, but many find it very difficult to get success at quitting the smoking habit. Nicotine is extremely addictive, and it makes sense that it's hard. Now, a lot of people have had success using what's called cognitive behavioral therapy. The way this works is to intervene at the time of the behavior, to give users alerts and information and support at the time that the behavior is a problem. The difficulty here is it's tough to have a therapist walking around with you while you're going throughout your daily life, and they have to sort of train you to be aware of the situations when they arise. Well, there's a company called Somatics, and this company does a lot of big data analytics, and they've applied their tools to the whole problem of smoking cessation. They've created a program called SmokeBeat, and what makes this special is it uses data from standard off-the-shelf smartwatches and fitness bands, because they have motion detection devices in them, accelerometers and so forth, and these can be mapped to the behaviors involved with smoking, lighting a cigarette, moving the hand to the mouth, and so forth. And so the system is able to detect when the user is performing smoking-type behaviors. At that instant, it's able to then trigger an alert of one sort or another to help the user be more aware of what's going on and to offer support and to offer suggestions on how to help quit smoking. The company did a study. They had two groups, a control group and an experimental group. The experimental group, whenever the system detected that they might be smoking, it simply sent them an alert and said, "I think you're smoking. Could you please confirm or deny this?" And just simply making the user more aware of when they were smoking apparently had a big impact. The other group was simply told that they were on a wait list to take part in the study. Both groups were given a questionnaire at the start and end of the 30-day test period. The results were very clear. Among those in the experimental group who got the alerts and feedback, they reported that their smoking activity had declined enormously, whereas there was no significant change in the smoking frequency of the people in the control group. Now, this is an interesting technique because it's using off-the-shelf devices, nothing fancy, nothing expensive, and simply applying big data analytics to the information that's already being gathered. The same technology can be used for other things as well. Somatics is working on a program that's going to be released later on this year called Safe Being. And what this does is uses the same off-the-shelf motion detection technology and their big data analytics technology to monitor the daily activities of the elderly, either living alone or living in a managed care facility. It's able to monitor and detect impairments, physical impairments or cognitive impairments, be they sudden or gradual over time. It can detect falls and issue alerts and help create a dashboard of behaviors so that caregivers and healthcare professionals can monitor to make sure that the subjects are eating regularly, are moving about their living space normally, and so forth. So again, big data analytics paired with off-the-shelf technology, it can turn out to be a powerful tool to help affect people's lives. One of the big problems with healthcare is we want it to be more cost-effective. We need it to be more efficient. We need to make it easier for people to gain access to healthcare without incurring great expense or going through great inconvenience. And one of the key ways to do this is through the use of telemedicine, using video, audio, remote monitoring technology, and things like that, so that patients don't have to come in for an office visit and sit for hours in waiting rooms, waiting to see a healthcare professional. A new patient survey by Software Advice shows that a lot of patients are open to the idea of telemedicine and, in fact, are actively pursuing it. They prefer it over normal procedures, at least to have that option. The study showed that 3 out of 4 patients in the survey said that they would be more likely to choose a healthcare provider who included telemedicine as an option. This is a great step forward. It shows that there's more pressure for healthcare providers to give this sort of an option to patients so that we can be more time efficient and more cost efficient for patients to contact a healthcare provider, get information, get answers to their question, so that problems can be detected earlier, treatment started sooner, and this is going to lead to better outcomes and better health for everybody. Artificial muscles sound like something science fiction-y, but in fact, it's a really important development that we need to solve in order to address a whole lot of issues. One of the basic ones is simply robotics. To have powered machines that can move about and articulate motion and perform tasks using efficient muscles that can contract and cause different parts of the robot to move. But it doesn't have to be a self-contained robot. It could be an exoskeleton, something that somebody who's either has impaired physical abilities or even is paralyzed, that could give them the power to move on their own. Or there's also the whole concept of powered prosthetic devices, a prosthetic arm that has the ability to move fingers and hands and wrist joints and to be able to grasp and manipulate objects. This kind of change from just a rigid hand would mean a much better quality of life for the patient who has it and help them be much more productive in their own lives and also to contribute to society. So the key is coming up with an artificial muscle that's inexpensive and effective. Researchers at the University of Illinois have come up with what may be a winning formula for artificial muscles. It uses carbon fiber that has been dipped in a rubber material. And then once it's coated with this, it's then simply twisted. In this case, they actually just twisted it using a standard electric drill. And once it's coiled up, it then contracts in response to a very small electrical current or heat or even a chemical input. It's lightweight, inexpensive, and the best part of all is it's amazingly strong. In their experiments, the researchers found that this material can lift 12,000 times its own weight. 12,000 times its own weight. That's amazing. So a very small amount of material can be used to affect a very large force. This is a really promising development. It could have a big impact on powered prosthetics, on exoskeletons, on robotics, a whole lot of things that are going to have a big impact on the quality of life and the health of individuals in a variety of situations.
For more information, go to healthtechinsider.com. This is Alfred Poor. Thanks for listening.
Thank you, Alfred. 5G mobile networks and wireless systems are the next phase in global telecommunication standards. Wireless connectivity has expanded far beyond smartphones and wireless LAN routers to new and previously unimaginable markets and applications. Technology has been evolving from person-to-person communications towards device-to-device connectivity throughout the connected homes, machine-to-machine, industrial, and automotive markets. Many are calling this the Internet of Things, or IoT. There will be new technological applications bringing profound advancements in deep learning, artificial intelligence, and ambient awareness. The way we do business and interact with each other today will be virtually unrecognizable, oh, perhaps in the next 5 to 10 years. The technological changes are disruptive. A simple explanation of what is the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things is becoming an increasingly growing topic of conversation both in the workplace and marketplace. It has the potential to impact how we live, but also how we work. But what exactly is the Internet of Things and what impact is it going to have on you, if any at all? Let's start with some basics. Broadband internet has become more widely available as the cost of connecting is decreasing and more devices are being created with Wi-Fi capabilities and sensors are built into them, technology costs are going down, and smartphone penetration is, well, skyrocketing. All these things are creating a perfect storm for the Internet of Things. The Internet of Things, simply put, is the concept of basically connecting any device with an on and off switch to the Internet and or to each other. This includes everything from cell phones, coffee makers, washing machines, different appliances, headphones, lamps, wearable devices, and just about anything you can think of that has an on and off switch. This also applies to components of machines, for example, a jet engine of an airplane, or the drill of an oil rig. If it has an on-off switch, then, well, chances are it can be part of the Internet of Things. The analyst firm Gartner Group says that by 2020, there will be over 20 billion connected devices. However, most other experts estimate that the number could be as high as 100 billion devices. The Internet of Things is a giant network of connected things as well as people. The relationship between people to people, people to things, and things to things. How will this impact you? Well, anything that can be connected will be connected, but why would you want so many connected devices talking to each other? There are many examples of what this might look like,
and what the potential value might be. Say, for example, you are on your way to a meeting and your car have access to your calendar and already knows the best route to take. If the traffic is heavy, your car might send a text to the other party notifying them that you will be late. On a broader scale, the Internet of Things can be applied to things like transportation networks, smart cities, which can help us reduce waste and improve overall efficiency. Talk of wireless networks ahead of the upcoming Mobile World Congress is leading many into believing that 5G networks could feed all of our internet device needs. But now is the time for industry leaders from around the world to develop and agree on standards for 5G networks, which are projected to switch on as early as 2019. 5G is the first network designed to be scalable, versatile, and energy smart for the hyper-connected Internet of Everything world. These next-generation networks and standards will need to solve a more complex challenge of combining communications and computing together to intelligence is at your fingertips and available in machines that make up the Internet of Things. Last year, Cisco, Intel, and Verizon, in a joint wireless network research project, revealed a novel set of neuroscience-based algorithms that adapt video quality to the demands of the human eye, hinting that future wireless networks would have built-in human intelligence. The 2G networks were designed for voice, 3G for voice and data, and 4G for broadband internet experience. With 5G, we'll see computing capabilities getting fused with communications everywhere, so trillions of things like wearable devices don't have to worry about computing power because network can do any processing needed. These 5G networks will be faster, but also a lot smarter. Devices will need to become smarter too, as they will act as networking nodes rather than just terminals. With 5G, computing power and information will feel like they're following you around, and wearables, smartphones, tablets, and other devices with sensors that are location and context aware will work together with apps and services that you use. Transition to 5G wireless technology will stimulate revenue growth for cell tower REITs, Crown Castle, and American Tower. New markets for wireless carriers will drive more leases for cell tower REITs as 5G opens the way for wireless to compete with fixed broadband services. All four of the major U.S. wireless carriers today, which includes AT&T, Verizon, T-Mobile, and Sprint, are investing now to test 5G systems in the 28 GHz and 39 GHz bands authorized by the FCC in 2016. Assignment of these high spectrum bands tell us a lot, as 5G signals won't travel so far as 4G signals due to the use of the much higher spectrum. That means delivery of 5G service will require wireless carriers to invest in more cell towers as well as in small cell and fiber networks to distribute 5G signals to targeted areas. Qualcomm announced its first 5G modem chip, Snapdragon X50, which was successful in a recent test in San Diego in October of 2017. Although the specifications for 5G have not yet been firmly set by the Third Generation Partnership Project, whose members are a collaboration of telecom makers in Japan, United States, China, Europe, India, and Korea, Release 15 came out in early 2017 with rules now accepted for standard 5G silicon manufacturing. First chip designers such as Qualcomm's Snapdragon X50 are now produced at low volumes, with handset vendors such as Samsung and Apple expecting to ship their first 5G products for use by commercial accounts by the end of 2018. Marty wants his cybernetic house to turn the volume down, slowly, and then turn the set off, and maybe the lights too, if you happen to doze off while watching TV. That may sound simple, but there are 7 separate parts of the process, any one of which could stymie the attempt to make it happen. Marty will walk us through, first identifying and then addressing each of these 7 challenges.
Hey, let's get to it, Marty.
So, what can a cybernetic house do if you doze off while watching TV? It's a topic we brushed by before, but this time, I want to organize the discussion around the main challenges and treat those individually. There is an order to them. Number one, recognizing when you doze off. Number two, if it's your bedroom, is there somebody else to consider? Number three, what should happen with the lights? Number four, is there a TV that's on? Number five, what remote codes does it take? Number six, how will we get the TV set to see those codes? And number seven, what if you replace or relocate the set? Let's start. How can automation know when you doze off? Our philosophy, of course, is that the house should recognize that on its own, without you strapping on a wearable or pushing a no longer awake button. We know there are small radar devices that can track your basic metabolic rate, pulse or heartbeat or whatever. We're playing with some really inexpensive hardware to see if we can gather that data from beneath the floorboards under the bed and maybe under the sofa or recliner. Where do you fall asleep? Let me throw a trick question at you. What's the pulse or heart rate that someone will always cross when transitioning between awake and asleep? Well, there isn't one. The only way to tell for sure is to watch for changes in readings, and if this wasn't a cybernetic house, that might really complicate things. But one of the things that makes it a cybernetic house is the MySQL database that can track those changes over time. So our first step in doze recognition is pulse monitoring done with radar. By the way, the radar doesn't need to be on all the time. Our thermal map of the house can recognize when you're in a place with a radar underneath and maybe after a minute activate the radar, turning it off again once you fall asleep. We're talking about roughly the same microwave exposure as some home alarm systems, and so far we're not aware of anybody turning into a mutant because of those. The second challenge has to do with whether or not you normally sleep alone, and if not, the status of that second bed position when you do doze off. There is some overlap between this and the third challenge. This one decides what to do with the TV set, and number three decides what to do with the lights. So let's go case by case. If you've both been watching TV and one of you is still awake, automation should probably do nothing. If it was just you watching and you normally sleep alone, then automation should gradually reduce the audio volume and then turn the set off. If one of you dozes off while watching and the other is awake, then automation should leave the TV alone but dim the room lights. And if one of you dozes off and the other is already asleep, automation should again reduce the volume and turn the set off and do the same with the room lights. Bedroom lighting has needed an injection of intelligence for a long time. When you turn on a TV, the lighting on the opposite wall should darken to reduce reflections on the screen. But whenever somebody gets out of bed or is expected to come in and go to bed, there should always be enough dimmed light to prevent stubbing toes or tripping over those floor castaways. We will have to test, but we are hopeful that our thermal maps will be able to discern the difference between somebody sitting up in bed, you know, like when you're reading, versus somebody who's under the covers with just a head propped up to watch the tube. The fourth challenge is knowing whether there's a TV that's on. This is a little complicated because off is never completely off, and standby modes might involve a variety of current levels. But in any case, the way to determine on versus off is by using a split winding transformer inside the outlet box that powers the set. We can set a threshold for a current level that means the set is on for viewing, not just in some sleeper's standby mode. We've started doing some measurements. We'll combine some new and old tricks for this. First, we will commit to the idea that sets are most likely to be mounted on walls, and so the outlet that powers the set should also be up the wall. Which wall? That depends on the room. In some rooms, there may be only one or two places a set can possibly go. In other rooms, there may be as many as 4 to 6. The new trick is to prepare a current monitoring outlet box on every wall that can possibly include a TV in that position. The old trick is to cover up the ones that aren't being used by hanging pictures or mirrors in front of them. In terms of our fifth challenge, the remote codes, I'd like to introduce you to a few of the TV sets in our house that no universal remote control, no cable system or satellite system or TiVo remote control has ever been successful at controlling. I think we got most of them at Target, so we're not dealing with rare and isolated models, but it does make something increasingly clear. Remote codes are harder to mimic than most people think. For one thing, they're not just sequences of pulses. They're sequences of pulses that are made up of very much faster carrier frequency pulses. It's not just boop, 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 boop. It's boop, boop, boop. If you want to mimic a remote, especially an obscure one, you need to be on that same faster carrier frequency, and you have to use the same logic to create your pulse train. Now, I don't count this challenge as solved, not just yet, but there might be an answer in the Texas Instruments MSP430FR4 microcontroller. MSP430FR4. It's capable of creating the necessary modulation and encoding once we know what those are. Fortunately, we're only looking for two codes, volume down and power off, or power off may be a toggle, which is why we need to monitor the outlet to know if the set is on so our automation doesn't go all Murphy on us. Short term, we may be able to read those codes with a fast infrared detector and an oscilloscope. With a little tinkering, we may be able to create an interface for that. The plan is to put that code-generating microcontroller into the cap, the ceiling pod housing in the middle of the ceiling. The MySQL database can determine which sets are in which rooms and what codes need to get sent in that room. But sending isn't receiving, which brings us to the sixth question. How will we get the set to see those codes? Most of the remote controls you've ever held in your hands use modest power infrared emitter diodes with fairly narrow angle beams. That's fine if you can even roughly point the remote toward the set or bounce it off a ceiling or back wall and hope that the ricochet reaches the set. We're going a little more brute force with our approach. Right now, we're looking at the Osram SFH4547 high-power infrared emitters. These are capable of casting 60-degree beams, 30 degrees each side of center, at the most popular consumer remote control wavelength, 940 nanometers. We're testing three variations with different levels of luminous intensity. Our plan is to place four of these on the ceiling pod, the cap, angled at 45 degrees from vertical, and placed on the north, south, east, and west edges. Now, they build these IR emitters to be bright enough to be the light source for see-in-the-dark surveillance cameras, and we don't want their brightness, even though it's invisible, to bother anybody. So, as it happens, some of our cameras we have used and test with, are sensitive into this part of the infrared spectrum. We can rig the diodes in a way that literally shows us how big a spot on the wall they can cover. Can't be sure yet, not until we test, but we think they can blast enough infrared into the room so any set on any wall can see it. The seventh challenge, the one at the bottom of our original list, and I'll be very impressed if you remember it, is what do we do if the set gets replaced or relocated? Part of the answer to that is in whatever gizmo we can cobble together that can understand what codes to send to a particular set. Part of the answer is in our MySQL database, where we can store the make and model of each set, its description, and its recipe for each of the two codes, and where, for each of those 30 ceiling pod, cap ceiling pod locations, we can associate each and every TV outlet in that room. And that's going to be none for many of them. But it can tell us which outlet has no set, and for an outlet with a set, which one of the sets is in that outlet. It's the beauty of the database. Yes, it will take a little owner interaction, but we should be able to keep it simple enough to work through a secured control interface, and no, I won't be talking about that today. Is it all worth it? It's probably not worth trying to roll your own. That's my curse, and you don't have to share it. Then again, if you can add it to a house for less than $100 a room, for rooms with both TVs and places to doze off, is that worth it? If it isn't worth it, then back off and forget about it. But if it is worth it, then back up, back up, back up, so it won't leave home without you.
Thank you, Marty. No, Marty, I wasn't dozing while you were talking.
I was just nodding my head in agreement.
Public service announcements of scheduled computer club meetings in the tri-state northeastern region.
The New York Amateur Computer Club has a presentation on virtual currency for dummies. The meeting time is 7 p.m. on a Thursday, May 10th, and they meet at the NYU Silver Building in Manhattan, New York. The Long Island Macintosh Users Group has their meeting on Friday, May 11th. Meeting time is 7 p.m., meeting at the New York Institute of Technology, located on the Old Westbury campus, Northern Boulevard and Valentine's Lane, in the auditorium of the Harry J. Schur Hall. Princeton PC Users Group meet Tuesday, May the 22nd, at 7 p.m., and they meet at the Mercer County Library in Lawrenceville, New Jersey. Brookdale Computer Users Group has a presentation on Set up and configure a home network. Thursday, May 24th, meeting time is 6:45 p.m., and they meet at the Middletown Library Lodge Meeting Room, located at 55 New Monmouth Road, Middletown, New Jersey.
The Amateur Computer Group of New Jersey has their general meeting on Friday, June 1st. Meeting time is 8 p.m. They meet at the Scotch Plains Rescue Squad, located at 1916 Bartle Avenue in Scotch Plains, New Jersey.
Danbury Area Computer Society has a presentation on net neutrality, Tuesday, June the 5th. Meeting time is 7:30 p.m., and they meet at the Danbury Hospital Auditorium in Danbury, Connecticut.
The Westchester PC Users Group has a meeting on Thursday, June the 7th. Meeting time is at 7 p.m. They hold their meetings at the Keller Williams Realty, located at 120 Bloomingdale Road, first floor in White Plains, New York.
By the way, if you never attended a computer meeting, you should attend. If you have any questions, this is a place you can go to where you can ask people about their experience and if they have any comments about products or problems that you may have. And all these meetings, they have a random access session that you will probably be able to ask your question, and there is no such thing as a dumb or stupid question in computing. All these computer club meetings are free and open to the public. We hope to see you at the meetings.
And for all you club members belonging to these organizations, please support WBAI and hopefully you can make a donation to keep the station pertinent, relative, and in support of the Personal Computer Show.
Our website is pcradioshow.org. We can be heard each Wednesday at 6 p.m. Eastern Time on prn.fm on the Internet and at 9 p.m. Eastern Time on WBAI-FM 99.5 New York, on the radio, or www.wbai.org, streaming on the Internet. In the meantime, stay in touch and keep on computing and back up, back up, and back up. I'm Hank Key. On behalf of Joe King and Michael Horowitz, we thank you for listening. Stay safe and healthy until we meet again, same time, same station, next week.